Justice Bell, who is officed up here, you can sit down, it's okay, and is here during every week, had unfortunately had to go back to Las Vegas, so she can't be here today. She is listening to the arguments and will be participating in our deliberations, however, and she wanted me to apologize on her behalf for being unable to be here today. Does appellant wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. May we reserve 3 minutes?
Yes. Okay. As you know, the light and the bell will come on to let you know when you hit your 3 minutes. If you plow on through that thereafter, that's on you. We just kind of give you the heads up, okay?
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. You may go ahead.
Your Honors, as an initial matter, I have a demonstrative timeline I was hoping to provide to the justices and to counsel. It's
okay.
For demonstrative purposes only.
Has counsel seen it?
I have not,
but I have a copy right here for him.
If you would.
I mean, to the extent that there is an argument in here, but it's already in the briefing.
Okay. You can approach if you would.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Never had anybody approach in the Supreme Court. But
right.
I miss people approaching, so.
Thank you.
I brought a copy for Justice Bell.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Appreciate that, counsel. And thank you as well, Your Honors.
Okay.
Chief Justice Presiding Herndon, Justice Lee, Justice Bell, good morning. My name is John Carlson, and I represent the appellant Taylor Johnson in this matter. Now, this case could easily be remanded back to the district court due to its facially deficient order, and this court could direct the district court to comply with Yoakum and apply, per Willard, the good cause factors under Rule 60.
Counsel, but did you argue Yoakum below?
We argued it in an incoherent manner, in a manner that I would admit, Your Honor, is not as thorough as perhaps we should have been. But our position on that, Your Honor, is that the court has the ability to correct plain error on the record below, and that's what that amounted to in the district court not addressing those factors in its order. But instead of reversing in accordance or remanding, I should say, Your Honors should instead issue an opinion, a written opinion that's published, addressing three very important issues of law of statewide importance for all civil practitioners and in order to aid the district courts in this state. First, the court should reaffirm Browning and extend it in holding that due diligence requires that a party notify an insurer that has made an appearance per Lindblom prior to applying for substitute service under NRS 140702. Second, the respondent calls putative defects with service under 140702 technicalities. Well, our client, the appellant, calls it due process. This court should convert its 2016 unpublished order from Carter versus Andrews into a statewide opinion reaffirming that a party must strictly, not substantially, comply with NRS 140702 in order to effectuate valid service of process, and in doing so, avoid what happened here. A party surreptitiously obtaining nearly $600,000 default judgment against an insurer, despite the insurer actually advising respondents' counsel that it not only intended to defend the suit on behalf of its insured, but that it had actually effectuated a prior settlement with that same plaintiff, the respondent here. And third, we would ask that the court issue an opinion clarifying that the burden of proof to show valid service of process is on the party claiming that valid process occurred. Here, that is the respondent, the plaintiff. And therefore, Your Honors, the district court, we respectfully submit, abused its discretion, and this court need not give deference to plain legal error, which the record is replete of here. Therefore, reversal is required in this case, Your Honors. Having gone over the Main points there, I'd like to, with the court's permission, just sort of elaborate a little bit on the main points that were made at the outset. First of all, Your Honor, substitute service should never have been permitted here because under the clear precedent of this court in Browning, if a party seeking to effectuate service, if the plaintiff is aware of the party to be served's employer or insurer, then under Browning, you simply have to reach out to either or both of those entities, depending on if you're aware of them. But if you know the employer of the party to be served, or if you know the insurer of the party to be served, Browning, which is very clear, on-point precedent from this court, says that you must try to obtain contact information to effectuate service from either or both of those entities. Here, there is no dispute that they did not try to do that. In fact, at the trial court level, they sort of mocked the notion, saying, well, GEICO would have never given that to us. But Browning is very clear, and it's very on point here. It does not say that if you make the self-determination that it would be futile, you don't have to ask the insurer for the for its insured's information or where it can be, the insured can be located. No, Browning says you must ask the employer or the insurer if you know of them. And that did not happen here. And therefore, as a very clear prima facie situation, they did not exercise due diligence as required under Browning and should never have been able to move beyond that point to effectuate substitute service under NRS 140702. As a second point, we would like to point out to the justices, as I'm sure you're aware, this court has a prior unpublished order from 2016 entitled Carter versus Andrews. The holding of that case is directly on point with the facts that we have here. And in that case, well, it's an unpublished order, and that's exactly why this court should basically apply the logic of that opinion and make it a published order to aid litigants and district courts throughout our state. Basically, Carter versus Andrews, this court said under 140702, in order to fulfill properly service of process, in order to effectuate it, you cannot just simply say good enough. You cannot say that substantial compliance is enough or we hit two or three out of the four prongs of the statute. No, you must hit four and all four of those prongs in order for there to be meaningful and legally sufficient service of process. And here the answering brief, I think that the term that they use is, well, we hit 3.5 out of four. Well, Your Honors, we would submit that that's basically an inherent admission that they did not effectuate proper service of a process under the statute. The Carter Court held very clearly that there are four elements to the statute, and you have to do all four of them. Here, that never happened. So again, as a matter of law, they were required to strictly adhere to the statute in order to effectuate service of process under 140702, allowing service through the DMV. That did not happen. And much like the failure to show due diligence was a clear error of law that this court has every ability to reverse the lower court for, the same thing happened, or should be applied here with respect to the fact that there was no strict compliance with NRS 140702, and therefore there was never any valid service of process upon our client, and the district court simply lacked jurisdiction to proceed as it did, period. It had no ability to exercise jurisdiction over him to enter the default, judgment, any of that, because there was never any valid service of process. His due process rights were not complied with, therefore, and the court simply lacked jurisdiction, and reversal is appropriate on this basis as well. And then the third point that I sort of hit on at the outset is that we think it would be a great benefit to litigants and district courts throughout the state for this court to clarify what we think is sort of implied throughout the court's jurisprudence, but basically formalize and make it known in a published order, an opinion, that if a party seeks to show service of process, or the service of process has been effectuated, that it's proper, then that party has to be the one that bears the burden of proof to come before the district courts in this state and basically prove and show that they've effectuated service, since they're the party that's claiming that service is proper. The burden logically can only rest upon them. The party seeking to effectuate service must bear that burden to show that service is proper. And here what that would have looked like is complete, faithful, and strict adherence to 140702, but instead we don't have that. And yet, and this is yet another reason why the burden should fall on the party claiming that service is proper to show, in fact, that it was done in accordance with 14070 or any other means of service of process in this state. A couple other points that I didn't touch upon at the outset, but with the court's indulgence, I'll just address them briefly here. We submit that Rule 55b-2 requires setting aside the default because GEICO under Landreth had...
Well, we're in 60B land, aren't we? Because this is a motion to set aside the default judgment, not the default, the former of which is not an appealable thing. So we're really focused on Rule 60B, aren't we?
I think that, yes, Your Honor, I fully understand your point, Justice Lee. I just thought it's worth noting and pointing out for the record that the legal error at the 55 stage requires reversal as well, because they were required under Landreth, given GEICO's clear intent to participate under Landreth and Christie, GEICO basically evidenced an intent to participate in the litigation, and therefore they were required to notify GEICO directly before they sought to enter the default through a 3-day notice. That did not happen here. The only 55, I think, was indicated that it was done by electronic service, as we argued in our briefing. GEICO was not signed up for electronic service, and basically the record indicates that while they contend they also served it by mail, you have to look at what the record shows, we respectfully argue, Your Honors, and the record shows e-service. So a party that's not signed up for e-service isn't going to get e-service. And there's
we don't have any jurisdiction to review that alleged error. We're focused on 60B in this appellate context.
Fair enough, Your Honor. And moving to 60B, we contend that it was an abuse of discretion under 60B for the district court not to go through the factors set forth in the Yoakum case, and as basically under Willard, the district court was required to go through each one of those four criteria and determine whether they were met. That didn't happen. That didn't happen in oral argument. That didn't happen in the order, and that was, again, an abuse of discretion. That was plain error and requires reversal. Sorry, Your Honor.
Do you think that the district court under Willard has an obligation on its own to evaluate and make specific findings of the Yoakum factors, even if you don't utter the word Yoakum?
Yes, because the court has to make sure that it has appropriately has jurisdiction, and I think under Willard that analysis is required, and it is basically incumbent upon the district court to conduct that analysis. I think it's pretty clear under this court's precedent that analysis has to be gone through regardless of whether it is argued as effectively as maybe it could be by the litigants. Yes.
So should we just remand for further findings by the district court?
No, because we think that a published opinion from this court reversing the district court for all the reasons that we've set forth, the clear errors of law, the lack of jurisdiction that the court possessed because of the lack of due diligence under Browning, the lack of adhering strictly to 14070 under this court's Carter versus Andrews opinions, which basically says strict compliance is required, and they didn't do that. Basically, the clear
let me interrupt you for a moment, because you said no in regard to Justice Lee's question about should we remand it to make the findings under Yoakum. It seems you kind of led with that the district court violated the law by not making the findings under Yoakum. So what is it that you're asking us to do if you think that's not the remedy?
We think that the court lacked jurisdiction over my client at all times, and that the judgment is void, and that the court should basically... What's that?
Because of the settlement?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yep.
But to get it back there to address that issue, we can't in the first instance say, hey, there was a settlement, and therefore this whole thing has to go away. I mean, that's a specific inquiry that the trial court should make as to whether there was a settlement, what was the nature of the settlement, was the settlement fraudulent, was the settlement valid. Those are all kind of evidentiary-related issues that we're not in a position to make in the first instance.
Well, that would certainly be met with our approval, Your Honor. Yes, we understand that. If that's essentially what one form of relief that we're requesting is for the court to basically... Can I just finish that?
You can finish
your talk. Basically, for the court to reverse, vacate the judgment, and have the court undergo analysis to determine whether there was a valid settlement that was reached pre-litigation. Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Got it. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Morning.
May it please the court.
Not afternoon yet.
from that point.
Your Honor, may I proceed?
Yes, please.
Okay. I want to take a couple of minutes, if you can allow me, to really frame the issue that is going on before the court. As you can kind of see by the appellate's handout, is that there's a lot of facts in this case. So there's a very narrow issue that needs to be decided on appeal, and really was service proper in this particular issue, which is a trial court's discretion in terms of what to actually determine was proper under NRS 14.070. Now, we're muddying the waters here because there is this GEICO looming out there, and I'm going to refer to this as a potential second case. And this case, it really is the first defense to that case, because ultimately what they're trying to do is cut this here in order for not to pursue a potential second case that's out there. Now, the narrow issue becomes is that was there due process, and whose due process did, you know, allegedly we violate? Was it Taylor's or was it GEICO's? Now, counsel refers to Browning in terms of that we should follow that one. The Browning case is very specific. It's a short opinion. And in that case, the driver or the defendant driver, he had actually handed a business card that had his employer on it. And there was these makeshift affidavits that process servers basically generally, you know, prepare. There's like the...
But counsel, why didn't you just reach out to the insurer? I mean, your client sent three prior demand letters to the insurer, mm-hmm. Asking for money after there was an alleged settlement, a recorded settlement. So it's not like your client didn't know that this insurance company was involved. Then there was no inquiry to the insurer, which was criticized in the Browning case. Mm-hmm. There was no inquiry to the insurer. And then once you get the judgment, then you're right back in. Going back to the insurer, going back to the well for an additional $500,000 after settling for
$800.
But that's, you know, so potentially, why not just go to the obvious source? I do see that you took some extensive efforts with governmental agencies, but why not go back to the insurer or even the passenger that was in the vehicle?
Well, there's a couple different reasons. One, none of the rules require it. Is it prudence to try to go and do these different things? But when you look at the affidavits of due diligence that we did do, and I'll get to your question. I'm not avoiding it. In common practice, I don't know that we didn't ask the insurer, do you have a current address? Now, we're filing this complaint close to 2 years after the actual accident occurred. And what we've kind of seen in the record here already is this gentleman, the defendant, moved several times, wasn't at the address. This fiance who was in the report, actually it looks like they lived together at the same time at that address in the police report, but then moved 2 months after the fact. Now we're talking 18 months, 20 months later, where they've already gone to Colorado in some fashion. Now, when I looked at the affidavit of due diligence, I looked at the declaration of Defendant Johnson, and I noticed that they had purchased a home. And then I looked at my own due diligence. I was like, wow, that's a red flag there, because, like, if they didn't catch that property record, like, there's obviously something wrong. That was a huge red flag. So when I actually looked at, you know, the address of the house that they lived at and did my own parcel search, he doesn't come up on that name. So there would have been no way for that process server to actually find Johnson in that instance. So again, we're talking about, you know, whose due process that we argue. And now, if you go back to Browning, and I will kind of in a roundabout way get back to that point, is Browning is a case where, and you're going to kind of see an underlying theme, where the service was dismissed because of various different, in Carter as well, various different issues. Insurance companies do not accept service for their clients. And that is a very hard and fast policy because they want you to go through these hoops. They want you to go through circumstances like Browning, which was a dismissal. They want you to go through circumstances like Carter. In that case where they had, I think, plaintiff's counsel failed to name the driver, the owner of the vehicle. They wanted to amend it. Service was quashed. So they're trying to, in this instance, trying to use all this circumstantial, they're trying to use the service of process statutes as a sword and a shield in this case, because most of these cases are dismissals. The plaintiff did not do something in with 120 days. They did not do something in an appropriate amount of time to cause a dismissal. So they're not trying to make this easy for plaintiffs to try to pursue this service. So asking service, I don't know if we did or not. You know, the record says that we did not. If that's in there,
should that be your burden?
I'm sorry?
Should that be your burden?
And absolutely, and we proved that burden in front of Judge Delaney, who went through the record, looked at the affidavits of due diligence. They looked through all the different types. And going back to Browning, it's not even the same situation, because Browning was a case where the defendant actually gave his or changed his address through U.S. Postal, had changed it through the DMV, or had made some affirmative changes to allow him to process server to be able to find him. There is nothing in the record here that shows that the defendant Johnson was updating his records, was on title.
But doesn't that make Browning that much more important? Because the idea of Browning was you can do all the routine checks. You can do power checks, utility checks, you know, whatever else you would do, property checks, et cetera. And if you can't find them, what Browning said was it was a failure of due diligence to not try and contact the employer or insurer that was known. Or insurer, not just employer, or insurer. So here, if you can't find them in any of these other things that you're checking, and I agree that absent this issue, you did due diligence, right? I mean, your process server checked all those routine things that we expect them to check. But I think Browning stands for that proposition that if you can't find them there and you know about this other thing, you have to at least ask. And I'm not quarreling with you that the insurance companies may want to, on occasion, make it hard. All right, I can accept that.
And I don't. And I
ask.
I don't disagree with what you're saying. I think that ultimately, what would be the easiest thing possible would be the legislature just said, "Hey, alternative service. If there's an insurance company, go serve the insurance company."
Yeah. Well,
that would be all. I mean, that would save all of this. But they don't, and the insurance companies do not want that. They want these hurdles in place to allow for difficulty. Because if you look at Defendant Johnson, he did not want to be served in whether it was intentional or unintentional.
Is there any evidence that he was actively avoiding service?
We couldn't prove that, honestly. I mean, honestly, the declaration was very, he said that he found out about it in the first instance when he got the default judgment in the mail in Colorado or something like that, because I think we ultimately tracked him down after the fact. I don't even know how we found him, to be honest with
and
you.
And so that kind of dovetails into the Yoakum analysis, where you have to analyze whether or not there was bad faith. None of that was done. It wasn't in the record. And we've held in Willard that we need that analysis to properly assess the default judgment on appeal, and none of that was done. I read the judgment was a paragraph, maybe two paragraphs. So there was really no explanation as to why the default judgment was allowed to be entered. So what are we to do with that? Shouldn't we remand it down so the court could do those?
I mean, that is a possibility to make those Yoakum analysis. I think we've argued it here. I think a remand with instructions I don't want to say that because I believe they did waive those arguments.
Let's talk about that a little bit. I know I brought it up with counsel, the appellant counsel as well. But, I mean, you would acknowledge there are certain things that we have told the district court. It doesn't matter what the parties do. You, judge, have an obligation to do certain things. To tell the jury about certain evidence they're going to receive when it's other bad acts in criminal cases, all kinds of different things. And here in Willard, I mean, we use the language accordingly. While our jurisprudence has already stated as much, we now explicitly hold that a district court must address the Yoakum factors when determining if a 60B1 move is established by a preponderance of the evidence. And then later on, as a result, we now expressly hold, as we have in other contests, that district courts must issue explicit and detailed findings. I can only read that to kind of say we're telling them, we're beating them over the head. Mm-hmm. We're killing the horse and dragging it around the courtroom, right? You have to do this. It doesn't matter what they do. You, judge, have to make these findings so we can engage in meaningful appellate review.
And I,
that's not your fault.
No, I understand. Mean, and it's also, I would argue reluctantly that that there are certain factors like attorney's fees that there has to be the analysis done.
Wasn't even done here, right? The amended judgment granting attorney's fees also has no analysis in it. What was the basis for the award of attorney's fees?
I'm not familiar if there was the case is escaping me, Your Honor.
Well, I have the order, the amended judgment, which grants the attorney's fees, and it's literally just saying, hey, we're adding attorney's fees,
okay,
with no analysis on what basis was attorney's fees granted.
We're escaping the attorney's fees analysis to case, and I can't remember it off the top of my head, but yes, that is correct. I think the order probably should have had that information.
There's no reference to Brenzel or
that's
Beatty.
That's Brenzel, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
that's
there's
what
no
I'm
Beatty reading. Analysis.
Yeah.
It just kind of gives an amended judgment, because the judgment, also very thin, just gives the amount. And then there was an amended judgment, which just literally lists the attorney fees granted with zero analysis as to the basis, the reasonableness, or any of that.
I don't want to make a representation. I believe there was an application in there. I do not know. I don't have the record in front of me. I wasn't prepared for that particular question. I'd have to look at the record, honestly, to answer that question, because I'm not sure. The Brenzel factors, usually something that is inherent when we ask for attorney's fees. But the order, again, you're probably correct. I don't know the record.
I'm trying to recall. I don't know that appellant raised an issue of the attorney's fees award on appeal, however.
No, they did not.
Okay.
Maybe that's
so
why
I'm not going to fault you for not having that in there, but let me ask this question. If it gets remanded back and we tell the district court you have to engage in an analysis of the Yoakum factors, in your mind, does the idea of the alleged settlement play into Yoakum at all?
I don't.
I mean, if there's, why was there a delay? Was there good faith in not responding? I mean, it would seem to me that potentially there might be some relevance to the court evaluating the settlement issue first.
Under the elements, yes, I think that does play into that issue. The problem becomes is that it really, well, at this stage, we kind of have to work backwards, that saying that there is the judgment would be voided, or at least if you remand it back down to make these factors and findings, I don't know if it's really up to the trial court's discretion at that point, whether they want to engage in those types of findings. That's not for me to really decide if that is relevant or not.
Okay.
I know all we can kind of say is that at least on the one hand, the legislature has already answered that question. So the legislature already said that this conduct is inappropriate and should not be allowed to continue. Now, I know that this is prior to that statute, but we're going to raise all those arguments the same, that lack of consideration, all the factors that you've discussed. So I don't know if it matters in a sense. I think it is relevant for the factors in one sense, but at the same time, I think a lot of those arguments were waived. So if there is a remand, I would agree that it's remanded for purposes of this analysis, but that a lot of these arguments have been waived in making those.
So basically, your position would be, hey, maybe there's some relevance to the settlement, but we shouldn't be weighing in on that issue right now. If it's going to be raised, it should be raised at the trial court when it gets remanded, if it gets remanded.
Yeah, I think that's putting the cart before the horse on that one. I don't, it's however the trial court would want to, you know, make that issue. And unfortunately that they have, the legislator has spoken on that issue. So I don't think we need to get there, but it still is it's still out there. That issue is not here before the court, I think.
Okay.
To continue very quickly, again, the deterioration becomes is whose due process is violated. And what ultimately is that Johnson just did not want to be found. Now, you can see the differences in how he was served and how that was handled versus the other cases. Now, we did serve GEICO. The GEICO did get communicated with. Now, when you look at the declaration from GEICO's representative, it's very cryptic. It's one person saying, it's not even the person who was being mailed to. They don't even produce, like, a claims file or any other evidence that would allow them to kind of show, can I continue the?
You can continue your thought, yes.
They don't allow, there's no evidence in there that kind of generally shows that, hey, listen, we had zero knowledge of this lawsuit. They clearly did have knowledge of those representation. And under other factors, is usually they do litigation searches. We did mail them. There's not, I mean, I don't, we can't.
Were they given the complaint?
What's that?
Were they given the complaint?
And if they did, it was faxed. I don't think the service was done. It's not required under the rule.
Right. I'm just.
The record doesn't show it, I think. But typically it is my practice to send it. Because realistically, that this case, if we are talking about a potential second case here, if this was just a normal car accident case where Mr. Johnson hit Melendez and Johnson was served, throws it away, you know, throws the complaint away, right? There's a default judgment. Well, the insurance company generally is off the hook. You know, there's no bad faith. There's no participation. The reason why this is a very, you know, why this issue is now being litigated as aggressively as it is because there is a potential for bad faith. And there is this potential that GEICO did know about this lawsuit. And I think the evidence and the record shows that, yes, they were alerted, they had knowledge, they didn't participate. So the Browning factors, as we come back to Browning, does show that there was at least some knowledge of it. Because the legislature is not clear, the rules are not clear as far as what is due diligence in for serving a defendant. Again, I go back, the legislature would make this easy and just say, hey, let's just serve the insurance company. But the cases are ripe with plaintiff's case being dismissed for lack of service. And that is the central issue you've got to look at, is that all of this other GEICO issue is somewhat a filler. The totality of it is that Johnson was properly served. He was not going to be found. All the mailings were going to addresses that he lived. There was three or four different addresses that we weren't doing. Even if you compare the Browning cases where the defendant in Browning actively took steps to update his address, there wasn't anything done here. So we can't force litigants, we can't force people to litigate a case. They are stuck with these decisions in some fashion. And you got to remember, it's like, whose due process are we actually violating here?
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honors. As to whose due process rights we're affecting, I think it's pretty clear. Taylor Johnson has a judgment against him based upon competent evidence in the record that he didn't know about for an amount in excess of $500,000. So it sure seems to me like his due process rights are affected here. The judgment is against him. It's not against GEICO. I just want to further reiterate, Browning is anything but a narrow opinion. It's not, as to the germane part of Browning, it's not dicta, nothing. It's exactly on point here. In order to show due diligence and be able to proceed with substitute service, you have to show that if you know the employer or the insurer, that you reached out and asked them for information. There's no question here that they did not do that. That's a fatal flaw under Browning. There was no due diligence as a matter of law, and so everything that comes after was inappropriate because the court lacked jurisdiction. I think that, it seems like the respondent acknowledged that they have the burden of proof to show proper service of process, so I just want to note that for the justices. In terms of the statute that is now in place with respect to settlement with an unrepresented litigant, as we point out in the briefing, that statute was not in effect at the time of this settlement. The record further shows that even if the statute had been in effect, that they were someone in respondent's position was required to return the consideration and to do so within 60 days of the settlement being reached. There's nothing in the record to show that that was done, and in fact, the evidence is to the contrary. So even if the statute had been in effect at that time, there was an adherence to it. But the bigger thing, obviously, is that statute, you know, was not even in effect during the pertinent time period.
Let me ask you the same question I asked Mr. Aon about the settlement issue. If we agree with you and decide that we need to vacate and remand the case for the court to engage in a proper Yoakum analysis and make findings, Is the idea of there having been a settlement something that we should be directing the district court to be involved in? Or do you think that is something that you guys go back and you can make a motion if you want? It seemed like the district court kind of sidestepped it down below and said, because I don't think there's a grounds to set aside the default judgment, the whole idea of a settlement is moot.
Absolutely right, Justice Herndon. I think the record is very clear that she said basically, hey, if I don't overturn under 60, then we don't even deal with that other issue. That's exactly what happened. So, yeah, we think that's absolutely a relevant consideration, because if Mr. Johnson and his insurer both thought that there was a settlement that had been reached, doesn't that go to their state of mind and their good faith and not thinking, having any reason to believe that there was a suit that was proceeding against Mr. Johnson? Absolutely, that's a germane factor in terms of the overall consideration and whether they acted appropriately under Yoakum and Willard. Of course, the state of mind thinking, hey, we settled this thing. Why would anybody think, oh, there's probably another.
Go ahead, you can finish your talk.
Why would anybody in our client's position think there's a suit going on? They settled the case. So absolutely, it's relevant under Yoakum and Willard.
Okay.
Justice Herndon, Justice Lee, thank you very much for your time today. Justice Bell as well. Thank you.